Lord, I just want to simply pray that you would speak to our hearts, that you would challenge us, and then minister to our hearts and transform us. Amen. Dean was in his late teens, and he had been entrusted with caring for the family home while his parents went on a 2-week overseas trip to New Zealand. And they promised, though, that with such responsibility, they would call every day to make sure that things were going okay. So the first 3 days, they would call up and they would say, how's the house? How's Nan, who was still there being cared for? How's the cat? How's the dog? And Dean would reply every day, they're all doing really well. 4 days into this overseas trip, the parents called up as they had done the previous 3 days, said, how's the house? Good. How's Nan? Good. How's the cat and the dog? Oh, the cat died. The parents were devastated. They sort of, you can't just tell us that the cat has died. You know, we're overseas. We can't do anything. We've had this cat in the family for 20 years, longer than you. This is devastating news. You really should have eased us into it. Dean said, oh, well, how could I have done that? And they said, well, maybe the first day when we rang today, you could have said the cat's on the roof and we can't seem to get it down. When we called the next day, you could have said, look, the cat's fallen off the roof. We're looking at taking it to the vet. It should be okay. Then when we called again, you could have said, well, the vet's told us things aren't looking too good with the cat, and they're doing everything that they can. And then when we called back, you know, 4 or 5 days later, you could have said, oh, the vet, sorry, couldn't do anything, and the cat has died. Then he said, oh, okay, that would have been a much better way of doing it. Sorry. So the next day they called up and they asked how everything was going. How's the house? Good. How's Nan? She's on the roof. Truth is something we want spoken and shown to us, yet we need to ask the question, how am I going at living and speaking truth? Am I a person of my word through what I do and say? And we see scattered throughout the Old Testament God's instructions to his people. They presented the way that they were to live, how they were to love each other, the boundaries that they were to set, and through doing so, that they would reveal God to the other nations. They were simply God's instructions on how they were to be a light to others. Some of you might have your notebook still for this series, and so we're going to put up some Old Testament references that you can go and read later on, that refer to, as we've been going through this series on the Sermon on the Mount, that today's passage, Jesus really starts to address in this context. So some of these references, and there would be others. In Exodus 20, verse 7, and Deuteronomy 5:11, it says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Now often we think that's about swearing, using God's name, but it's actually in the context of people who would come up and say things like, and some of us may have heard things like this, God has told me that we're going to get married. The God might say, well, if you contribute, that they might say, God has told me that if you contribute to this cause, he will bless you. Or using it to say that, well, God's told me that this is where you should be going on your next mission overseas trip. When in fact, in all those situations, God hasn't told them that. So that's the context of that. When we use God's name for our own purposes and advantage. In Leviticus 19:11-12, it says, you shall not steal. You shall not deal falsely. You shall not lie to one another. You shall not swear by my name falsely, and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. In Numbers 30, verse 2, if a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Deuteronomy 23:21-23. If you make a vow to your God, you shall not delay in fulfilling it. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. But if you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin. You shall be careful to do what has passed your lips. for you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. Psalm 50, verse 14. Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and perform your vows to the Most High. And finally, Zechariah 8, 16 and 17. These are the things you shall do. Speak the truth to one another. Render in your gates judgments that are true and make for peace. Do not devise evil in your hearts against one another, and love no false oath. For all these things I hate, declares the Lord. So there's some Old Testament context for what Jesus starts to address with his disciples in regard to how his followers should live. And we see that unpacked in Matthew 5, 33 to 37. And if you have a Bible, you might want to turn to that as we move on from what we have seen Jesus speaking about so far in this series, Sermon on the Mount. So Matthew 5, 33 to 37. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, the references we've just been reading, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, Jesus says, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. So why is Jesus addressing this with his disciples and the people who would have been around listening? The question can be asked, is Jesus continuing on this theme of marriage and commitment that we've been hearing about in previous weeks? Is he talking about the commitments we make in those relationships? And it appears not. It would be more a case of Jesus saying, like a segue, having talked about marriage, part of that's commitment. So let's talk about commitment as it relates to God and all relationships. The tradition has been established from these Old Testament references that we read before that people would swear before God, or even those outside of God's people, people who weren't even who worship false gods and deities. There was this desire that they would bring weight to their word and their commitments and what they ask of other people by swearing on a deity that what they've said or what they said would be done would be fulfilled or is true. And so there was a great fear around a commitment like that because people felt that if they swear on God or before God, then should they not do it, or if it would be proven to be a lie, then they would invoke the wrath of God upon themselves. But as time went on, people started to cotton on that if they swore on something else other than God, like Jerusalem or heaven or the earth, then they couldn't possibly invoke the wrath of God. And so you would have people making vows to each other and sealing that by swearing to something else that would be true or that something would be done. So you have the difference. You have, I make a commitment or a vow, and I swear or make an oath that it's true or it will be done. And as always, the human heart finds loopholes. People started to play the system. Some people started taking these oaths to a casual level. So if they didn't fulfill them, well, it wasn't really a binding oath anyway. But there will be those who took it beyond that relaxed state to the level of deceit, to manipulate others for their own gain. And what's worse, some of these people were God's people. They were saying they would do things with no intention of doing them. They would say things were true when they simply weren't. And what's worse is that the religious leaders, the Jewish religious leaders, were permitting this to take place. If you said you would do something for me and it wasn't done, and I took you before the courts, and the judge, hoping that the punishment would be brought, you really wouldn't have a case to answer for because it wasn't a binding oath to start with. And so we have another area where God's people were meant to be a light, but instead they were being a burden and a curse to others. They were living the law, but finding loopholes within it. God's people are called to be different to the world. And Jesus begins to make this clear through some of his Sermon on the Mount. God's people are meant to be countercultural. Jesus is readdressing the life that is to be lived by his people. And you can understand that Jesus was hated by, why he was hated by the religious leaders. And he was making it clear that the righteousness of the Pharisees and the Sadducees was not in their actions and words and how they lived. The greater righteousness that allows us access to heaven, it lays in the heart motives of us, not in our actions. And things had gotten so bad that there was even a complete written outline of what sort of oaths were appropriate and what weren't appropriate. It was written down for referencing so you could go and check. So it's like this. I create something that's meant to be helpful. Let's say a car. I know, right, me. The car is designed to keep you safe, get you places, and ensure others are kept safe. And this is, if you like, what God has given us through the law of Moses. Then I leave the car in the hands of some key people who are meant to help others understand how to drive cars. Except what they do is decide that they will hold on to the keys. And when you want to drive the car, well, you'll need to perform a series of tests before you can even get near the car. They also then decide that you actually have to be a particular race or religion to come near the car. Also, once in the car, you can't actually drive, as only they are allowed to drive. And what's more, as a passenger, you must provide the food and snacks and only listen to the music that they want to listen to. And no driving with the windows down, and the air conditioning can only be used when they want. Sounds a lot like driving with me. God's original intention has been uglified. How's that for a word? Then Jesus comes and says, guys, you've forgotten what the car is meant for. I'm bringing you back to the basics, the original heart of the matter. And that's what we see happening. God knows that we can't properly execute justice and love, and we don't naturally think of others. So we were given the law of Moses to guide us. God has given us the law of Moses to guide our corrupted hearts. But instead of the law guiding us and ensuring we are people of compassion towards others, the law has become a noose around our necks, only making us legalistic and exclusive. Instead of being people of love, we've become hard. And sometimes people can see that in us as the church, as they view in. We, like the Jews, the Israelites, have not only found loopholes, but we find that in the Jewish nation, the religious leaders have been the worst by showing us how to live with the loopholes. They've been living them as examples. And I encourage you to read all of Matthew 23, just to see how bad things had got and what Jesus had to say to the religious leaders. But in the context of what Jesus says to us today, here's what Jesus had to say to the religious leaders. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, if anyone swears by the temple, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that has made the gold sacred? And you say, if anyone swears by the altar, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift that is on the altar, he is bound by his oath. You blind men, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? So whoever swears by the altar swears by it and everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And whoever swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. In the context that we're looking at, Jesus is speaking to his disciples about a new style of kingdom living. And here, Jesus is speaking to those who should be leading the people in how to live. Jesus comes and says, okay, time out. Let's come back to the matter of our hearts. So we have God's people who are a part of a culture of deceit and lies, who are swearing and taking oaths that actually mean very little, because they weren't swearing before God, so it's okay. But Jesus reminds them about how fooled they are. Who reigns over Jerusalem? Who reigns over the hairs on our head? Who reigns over the temple? Who reigns over all things, over the whole earth? God does. So by swearing on anything means you are still swearing before God, because this is all His. Anything we swear by is God's, and we own none of it. Simply let our yes be yes and our no be no. None of these things that we would swear by belong to us, and nor do we have control over. It was important to Jesus that what His disciples, what His followers said, that alone could be trusted on its own merits, without any oaths or swearing. We see evidence of this in the early Jesus communities, the early church, in Acts chapter 5, verse 8. Let me read that to you. We have Ananias and Sapphira, who have supposed to have sold their property and given all their proceeds to the church. In Acts chapter 5, verse 8, we have Sapphira come in. And Peter says to her, tell me whether you sold the land for this amount. And she said, yes, for that amount. But Peter said to her, how is it that you have agreed together with your husband to test the Spirit of the Lord? Behold, the feet of those who have buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out. Immediately she fell down at his feet and breathed her last. When the young men came in, they found her dead, and they carried her out and buried her beside her husband. And great fear came upon the whole church and upon all who heard of these things. Neither of them swore, neither of them took an oath. They simply spoke a lie amongst God's people. In James 5:12, we have the words of Jesus echoed. Above all, my brothers, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth, or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. When I was 3 and 4, my parents were missionaries with the Salvation Army in Papua New Guinea, based in Port Moresby. And I don't remember much of that, but those of you who may have known me for a while, many of you may not have ever noticed, but I have a scar that comes down the side of my forehead. And on a particular day, my parents with some other missionaries decided to go on a picnic. What they didn't know, of course, was that two tribes had actually arranged to do battle at the exact location where we'd gone for our picnic. And as soon as that happened, they got out of there as quick as they could. But in the process, I managed to get an arrow caught that sort of just went, grabbed my skin and tore across my forehead. Now, Connor, if I was telling that story at home, what would be a question that you would probably ask me? Am I telling the truth? That would be a question that would come out of someone's mouth in our family. You see, we have a code at home. We have a value. That is, you can say whatever you like, really. You can be as imaginative as you want. But when the question is asked by someone else, in our family, are you telling the truth? The answer to that question can only ever be yes or no. That story I told you is not true. But it is true in some aspects. I was in Papua New Guinea as a 3 and 4-year-old. My parents were missionaries in the Salvation Army, and that's a story I like to tell about my scar. I actually fell down 27 cement stairs and cracked my head open on the last one, which took some skill. But there's a problem. You see, there's one flaw with that value, with that rule in our home. All it takes is for someone in our family unit to decide, I'm not going to live by that code. At that point, when that person decides that, the moment that happens, our trust and integrity and value in our home disintegrates. We can no longer trust each other. Truth no longer is a foundation for us as a family unit. I was listening to Finally Friday, a segment on ABC Radio in Friday afternoons, and there was a tone of suggestion that as a result of the recent storms, that you could claim from some insurance companies up to $500 for food that was lost without any accountability or evidence required. And the host asked one of the panelists, do you know how much food you would have lost? And the panelist replied, I just hope my insurance company isn't listening right now. There have been many stories of people claiming money they did not need from Centrelink or insurance companies during our recent storms. And we can justify it, can't we? Well, I pay my taxes. It's only fair. I pay my premiums year after year. I've never made a claim. It's only fair that I get some of that money back. Aren't we owed money by these multinational companies living off our profits? Isn't this just the little guy winning? Yet did we lie? Did we twist the truth? Does the enemy come and we find a way to justify? But it's not kingdom living. It's not how followers of Jesus live. It's lying. We think that there's no accountability, so we can do and live how we like. But if we call ourselves followers of Jesus, we are to be people of integrity and truth. We need to remember that we are the only Bible some people will read. We are a part of what reveals the kingdom of God to people. People will be drawn to God as they encounter the kingdom in and through us, as we live it out amongst each other. I was at a one-day seminar this week being held at the school for fathers, and the facilitator asked this question: as dads, what would you want said at your eulogy by your children? What would you want said at your funeral by your children? I would hope that honesty and integrity in our speech and the physical words that follow that, physical action, sorry, I want that to be part of my legacy. It would be good if it was part of our legacy, not for our own reputation, but because it points to Christ. What about gossip in the church? Lies in the church about each other? We can't call ourselves a follower of Jesus and do this. We just can't. Lying cannot be part of our community, our faith family. Jesus followers, we need to tell the truth. It's one of our identifiers. It's one way people will see that we are followers of Christ. And we don't need to say, I swear I'm telling you the truth. I swear on my mother's grave I'm telling you the truth. We need to be wary of twisting the idea of I promise or I swear to our own advantage, for our own prestige, to gain credibility. Because it's all about manipulating our language for our own convenience. It's about us finding loopholes. We are called to be honest in our taxes, whether in a business setting or in personal. What about in our business dealings? Someone provided an example this week of when people want to pay cash to avoid paying GST so they can get something cheaper. Jesus makes it clear. Pay to Caesar what is Caesar's. Our word, simply by itself, needs to be binding, not how great an oath we take. In fact, no oaths at all. No swearing, no oaths. What about if we are asked to take an oath in a court of law, swear on the Bible? Does it mean that we don't take an oath in the witness stand? The reality is, it's part of our national court judicial system, so we would. However, it would change nothing of what we would normally do or say. Before others, we may need to take that oath, but before God, our testimony would remain the same. Even Jesus was asked to testify before the living God when arrested and before the religious leaders. He was asked to swear before God that he was the Son of God. And to this, Jesus replied, "You have said so. It's true." And so too, when we make a commitment in marriage, or when we sign a contract, two very different things, but we take these things seriously. When we are asked to do something, and we say we will, we need to do it, acknowledging as much as we have control over it, whether it's by a particular time or a particular day. What about Facebook? Not everyone's on Facebook, but a few of us are. I asked a friend this week who I cycle with. I asked him, I explained the context of what I was talking about this morning, and I asked him, have you ever experienced the phenomenon where events are set up, you can set up events, and people can say that they will attend or they won't? And you have three options. You can say yes, you can decline, or you can tick maybe. And so this is what he said. I've seen it lots. It happened even this morning on our ride. Also, I think people use the maybe option because they don't want to say no. We need to live differently to the world. We need to be different. We need to be reliable in as much as we can control it. Another practical area, Tom. Recently, our children have started catching the bus. And late last year when they started doing that, they said we didn't have a bus pass, and I would give the children money, and they would say, "Oh, the bus driver never asks to see our bus pass or ask for money." And in that context, in contexts like those, it'd be easy to go, "Well, it doesn't matter." But we need to show integrity. We need to be people that are different. What about the old ancient requirement of RSVP? A friend of ours recently got married, and I saw that she was constantly asking for people to respond. The day before her wedding, one couple called her who had said that they were coming and said to her, "We won't be coming tomorrow." It wasn't because they were sick or because of an accident in the family. They said, "We don't know anyone, so we would feel uncomfortable." That's not a decision that you make the day before the wedding. It's about honoring people. And this isn't about returning to old school polite commitments. It's about continuing to be countercultural. In some ways, it is an old fashioned sentiment, but we just need to be people of our word and people of the word. It's about putting in every effort to be reliable. It's about truthfulness. It's about faithfulness. It's about honor. We do want our word to be unquestionable, yet need simply to ensure that our actions and words are reliable. And again, not for our reputation, but for the reputation of Jesus, who we say we follow, and the kingdom that we want to usher in around us and that we want other people to taste. When we try to take an oath or swear that something is true or will happen, we can miss the subtle twist of what's actually taking place. We can miss that we are really implying that we are sovereign, that we are in control of our lives and of our own destiny. What is at stake here is relationships with our family, our church family, and the broader community, many, many who are yet to still enter the kingdom. We would hope that they would see honesty amongst each other here, and that they would be drawn to Jesus and his kingdom. What about when you ask me to do something, be a part of a team, and I tell you, "I'll pray about it," rather than just actually being honest with you when I want to say no? We need to be cautious that we aren't using "I will pray about it," which by itself can be genuine, but we need to be cautious that we aren't using that phrase as a buffer so we can buy time to figure out how we'll politely say no. Equally, we need to be creating a culture, though, where we give permission for people to say no. So there's no need for others to break their commitments. We need to honour other people in that way. Some of you know that I am fortunate to head up our kids' club team called Dynamite. And I give my team the opportunity every year through a survey and asking them, "After this year, do you feel like it's time for you to move on into another area of ministry or just simply out of Dynamite?" But I do expect them, when they say yes for another year, that they're in for another year. They don't need to swear or take an oath or sign a contract, but I expected their word to be simply true. But every year, I do give them the opportunity to say no. We think we are living justly as per the requirements of the law. And we can be fooled into reading these verses, and we can think, you know what, initially they're just three verses that actually apply to me. We can feel like we have a good handle on it, but the reality is our hearts are corrupted. What about God willing? Is this an excuse, or is it actually genuine? Do we say, "Well, hopefully I will be there on Saturday, God willing"? The danger is that this can become just like taking an insincere oath. By itself, if it's the heart behind it is genuine, it's nothing wrong with it. With my cycling, I try and do as many group rides as I can, and often that means meeting at 4:50 a.m. in the morning so we can leave or roll out at 5 a.m. Sometimes there's only two of us who've committed to going. Imagine the impact of my witness if I was someone who was regularly described as a DNS, as a did not show. What would be the impact of my witness amongst them? What if I, the night before, went, well, I said I was going, but if God wants me to be there, he'll wake me up. I won't worry about setting my two alarms. And my car's empty of petrol, but God will find a way to fill that up between now and tomorrow. And it's a 30-minute drive, but if I only leave 15 minutes to get there, God will take care of that as well. God willing, I will be there. We've already mentioned it today. What about the church roster and our commitment to that? How do we find ways to hold ourselves accountable to the things that we will say we will do? This can be tough teaching, but Jesus has always said, if you want to follow him, you can't just be a fan. If fans don't turn up to games, the game still goes ahead. But we aren't fans. We are on the team. And being on Jesus' team is a big commitment. And it's a hard and high calling. It sometimes even feels like it's monastic in its nature, in the things that we are called to be and do. But I believe it can even have a broader impact to the foundations of our faith if we approach our relationship to Jesus in the same way, with that casual attitude. We say we follow Christ, yet is our commitment to him the same sort of flexible and maybe nature, controlled by convenience? As long as things don't get too tough or get in the way, I'm not asked to sacrifice too much, I'll maybe keep following him. Are we a follower or simply a fan? And we need to have a commitment that goes beyond the swaying of the wind. We are his disciple. We are his follower. As a parent, what about as a parent? As parents, our children will ask us to promise. I know there have been times when Mackenzie has come to me and said, do you promise? And some of us have seen the devastation that unfulfilled promises can make in our lives. Some of us have experienced those, or we have seen it around us. We need to spare our children deep disappointment from broken promises. But we also need to honor them by making real the nature of the world and the sovereignty of God. We are not in control of our lives. We cannot make promises. We can say that we will do our best and mean it. We can say that we will put everything in place, that we will try to do what we have said we will do. But our children need to understand that God is sovereign, that we are not in control of our destiny and our world, and that this world is his, and his will is what will come through and what we want to see come through. But as long as, again, we're not ever using that as an excuse to avoid our commitments to our children. The kingdom living that God calls us to, as example and taught by Jesus, it's not a set of rules. This isn't another set of rules meant to tie us down and make us feel bad and restrict us. When we are people of integrity in our word, it brings freedom. And in this case, a life of integrity, where we don't have to prove ourselves and strive to make our word believable. It would only take two or three times for what we say to be followed up on, and our word is enough. When we make our word believable, our actions believable, it brings freedom. When our word is trusted and reliable, we are free to relax and just say what is true and real, without the need to dodge and weave and maneuver through complex relationships where we try to remember what we have said we will do and what we have not. Because the reality is, the enemy does not want us to experience freedom and peace. When we have to build up our words with false swearing and we need to make oaths, We complicate relationships and can undermine the value of the relationships around us. The reason this comes from evil is because it is the opposite of integrity. It is the opposite of freedom that God wants us to have. What makes it evil is how it undermines the value of honesty in relationship. Because we can even be tricked into thinking that we can make oaths and promises to God. We can't. We are fickle beings and we fail and we stumble. And the enemy wants us to beat ourselves up when we say, God, I promise I will get up every morning this week and do devotions with you for 3 hours before I go to work. And when we don't do that, the enemy comes with his accusing finger and says, what sort of follower of Jesus are you? There isn't freedom in that. There's only beating up. God wants us to be free from that. So there's no need to make promises to God. We just ask him to transform us. Because God can make promises to us. God is faithful and reliable toward us. Instead of placing our hope and our word in what we cannot promise, we need to celebrate that we can place trust in what God promises. We think we can make a vow toward God and give weight to that vow through swearing and making an oath. And that's the difference. A vow is what we think we can commit to. And swearing is us thinking we can add value to the vow by swearing by what we say we will do. But we can't play with God. It's already been described twice already through this series. But we need a heart transplant. And that's what Jesus is sharing on this Kingdom of the Mount series. What hope do we have when Jesus says, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees and scribes, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven? How do we find hope in that? When we know that Jesus isn't speaking about our actions, but our heart, what hope do we have? We have the knowledge that it is Jesus who transforms us, transforms the corrupted nature of our heart, of our motives, and it is Jesus who helps us to be people of our word. It is in Jesus that we find the strength to simply say what we mean and to act with grace towards others and let his word be our word. We have no hope by ourselves except through the transformation and transplant of our hearts. It is through Jesus' righteousness, not our own, it is through Jesus' righteousness that we enter into heaven, and we help others experience that now in the way we live and reflect Christ amongst them. I'm going to pray. Jesus, transform my heart. Continue to transform my heart that I might be a person of integrity and reliability. Lord, I want to pray that you would reveal the areas in my life where I fail to show you to others, where I fail to reveal the kingdom. Help us as faith community, help us as followers of you, if we are brave enough to call ourselves a follower of you, continue to transform our hearts that those who are outside the kingdom in our family, our neighbors, those we work with, that they will experience and taste a magnificent kingdom of freedom that comes through simply letting a yes be yes and a no be no.